So given that this is the last talk, and I'm sure everyone is talked out, I will determine the length of the seminar by gauging the interest of the audience. So it's subjective, and I'll look around. And I'll see how many nodding heads I see, and then we'll determine how long we go. What's that? Yeah. So I want to talk about something that's even further afield. It has nothing to do with gravity. Well, not true. It does has something to do with gravity, but rather indirectly. In 26 dimensions. Well, in zero dimensions, actually. What I'd like to talk about is the application of world line effective theories to statistical systems. So, and I'll tell you how I got involved in this. I heard a talk by Marcus DiCerno, who is a biophysicist at Carnegie Mellon, where he was discussing this problem of fluctuations induced forces on membranes. So in particular, what they're interested in is if you have a soft condensed matter system, say like a cell membrane, and I place, I don't know, say two proteins down on the membrane, and I want to ask if I allow the membrane to fluctuate, what happens to the membrane, right? So in particular, there's some fluctuations at finite temperature. This is not a quantum system. And the proteins act like they're pinning down the surface and induce some boundary conditions. And as such, the fluctuations will induce a force. And you could think of it much like a vacuum Casimir force, except now thermally induced on a membrane. And why, you know, if you ask me detailed questions about why this is interesting from a biological point of view, all I can say is I believe what the main interest is because there's some interest in asking questions about how proteins facilitate membrane transmission through membranes. So you can imagine that if I take two proteins down and they start attracting, then the membrane will start to, right? In principle, you know, so if I start off with two proteins here and they're attracting, they will pinch it together, and either the pinch can go up or down. And you can imagine that this could be some sort of transport mechanism where eventually they pinch off and something which was sitting here can get inside the cell wall without the, right? Probably not. No, I'm just saying that if I have a, and I'm this is conjecture on my part. So take it as such. So if you have, you can imagine that if you had a cell membrane and I put down two proteins, and they say they attract to each other, but they're pinned down to the cell. So that will cause the cell to deform. And in principle, that can affect transport mechanisms across the cell membrane. That's my cartoon understanding. Okay, so So the toy model they consider in such cases is consider the Euclidean plane, and I put down an inclusion, right? So these things act as membranes, and I consider say a hole there. I consider it like a hole, and the hole pins down in some way, either some boundary condition, the membrane. And so what I want to do is I want to calculate the free energy of this system, right? Because if I know the free energy as a function of this distance r, then I can calculate the force law between the membrane. Okay? So what you want to do is calculate the partition function, right? So right? And so this phi field, so this, of course, is something that comes up in string theory all the time, right? So in string theory, you're calculating partition functions on two-dimensional surfaces, which are the world sheets of the strings, right? And and it's more complicated in string theory because string theory you have to sum over all topologies and over all moduli. And what we're interested in here is actually something much simpler, right? Because this is one gauge slice of a string partition function. So when I first saw this, I said, oh, I mean, this has been calculated string theory, so I'm sure you know the answer to this. But they're not really interested in this configuration for reasons which I'll explain, because for what they're interested in, they don't need to calculate anything this complicated, right? And because you can choose another gauge slice, which is diffeomorphic to this gauge slice, which is much easier to calculate, namely the cylinder, okay? But we're not interested in it. We're interested in a fixed topology, right? And we don't have, the system doesn't have all the, I'm not integrating over metrics on the world sheet, right? So we have to figure out what the relevant degrees of freedom are. And one can do this in a completely reparameterization invariant way. In principle, you could parameterize the world sheet by sigma and tau, like you do in string theory. But the way, simpler way to do it is instead of imposing full reparameterization invariance, it's just to choose a gauge and define a height function phi of x, right? Which is the height above some Euclidean plane. And that's a gauge choice that's sometimes called the Monge gauge in soft condensed matter physics. Okay? So phi is what they call the height function, right? And for us, it's some bosonic field that lives on a two-dimensional surface. Okay? So one can write down a reparameterization invariant action for the height function, but we're going to consider a derivative expansion considering only small fluctuations. Okay? So H is going to be some kappa, some function of the field. Or this is the Hamiltonian density. So so for us, at leading order in the derivative expansion, we would just have a free boson. Okay? And so we'd like to calculate the partition function for free bosons sitting on a Euclidean plane. And we'd also like to do it for arbitrary shapes. Right? So not just for circles. You'd like to be able to take proteins and model them as rods or ellipses. And I'll show you how we can do that. Now, there's some interesting things about the field theory that I learned from soft condensed matter physics. So so this thing is called the tension. And this is called the bending modulus. Okay, and sometimes they like to keep this and drop that, and sometimes they keep that and drop this. So when they keep this and drop that, they call that a film, a model of a film. And when they keep the bending modulus and drop the tension, they call that a membrane. Okay, now from a field theory point, it's kind of interesting, which is something I still don't completely understand, is does it really make sense to drop this, given that this is a relevant operator? So this is for the quantum field theorists in the audience. And you think that renormalization group running, once I included nonlinearities, would induce this. So how do you fine tune that to zero? And I don't understand the answer to that. And I don't know. So it's not, it seems to me like it's highly unnatural to consider that a model of a membrane. What's that?
Well, maybe it's just tuned, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's just tuned, but the question is, in nature, the membranes, are they really fine-tuned like that? That's an right, so that's an interesting question. It seems like, yeah, you just fine-tune it. The question is, why is that a good model for a membrane?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah.
There's another logical possibility that it exists, but it's not important for a specific question.
No, that's all right.
Well, the question, yeah, so the question is it important for the partition function? So so now this kernel has nice properties that it's conformal. So this is conformally invariant. And in string theory, of course, we utilize conformal symmetry to calculate everything. Whereas this kernel is not. Although it has some invariance under a subgroup of the full conformal group. So, time permitting, I'll show you how to solve this problem both using effective field theory and how to use conformal field theory to solve the problem. And I'll show you, remarkably, that you get the same answer. So it's shift invariant. But then I'll try to convince you at the end that the effective field theory method actually has more powerful, and that it can solve this theory exactly, whereas you can't solve that theory exactly using conformal field theory.
I think the answer would you could write down a derivative phi to the fourth term.
Yes.
But you only want to look at.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. So you could. So there is a derivative. Phi to the four. Oh, you mean quartic? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's what I
mean. Oh, okay. Yeah. So nonlinearities you can show are suppressed by powers of the bending modulus over over KT. So the nonlinearities. So you can calculate all. You can write down the full actions, just like root GR, right? And you can get all the nonlinearities in a similar way just by imposing diff invariance on the two surface.
What about the measure? Is it obvious that that's the right measure if you start out with a reparametrization invariant?
So the question is, when you want to calculate the nonlinear pieces, you'll have to take into account the proper measure, and that's a tricky question.
Okay,
that's something we just started thinking about. Okay, so question?
No, it's phi. What? Sorry, maybe I missed something. What does phi really mean?
Phi is the height above some base plane of the film.
Uh-huh. So it's also there.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So there is some notion of Galilean symmetry in a way, right?
Like this. In which direction?
No?
So I've chosen.
There's no
time this, here. This is a gauge.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, but maybe this Galilean. Oh, no.
This is a particular gauge choice, I mean.
Yeah.
That's why it's derivatively calculated.
No, I know, but maybe why these guys will drop the first term, we'll have to do some symmetry.
Okay, so so how do we approach this from effective field theory? So now, this is exactly like the black hole problem, right?
Except
so when I mentioned that to the biophysicist, I said, oh, you guys are just doing black hole interactions, and then they threw me out.
The gravity people might throw you out.
That remains to be seen, we'll see. But I'm willing to accept that. Okay, so there's a distance r between the holes, and the holes, let's take the typical size of the holes to be little r. Then we know that in the limit where we consider little r over big R to be much less than 1, then we can consider the point particle theory, right? Now, so the first thing you should say is, well, okay, when we do black hole interactions, we put in the first finite size effect, but we know there are infinite number of finite size effects, and we'd have to match all of them. Now, so when I have to admit, so when we first started looking at it, I said, okay, well, let's just make some approximation, and we'll take this approximation, we'll calculate to some order in little r over big R, right? And that'll be good enough because that's all the people in the community calculated anyway. So most people had only just calculated the first order in big R or little r, maybe the second order, some I don't know, third order, whatever. I don't know. But later on, you'll see that what's special about two dimensions is that we'll be able to calculate. So if we write down, so here's our action, or our Hamiltonian. So we have d phi squared, d2x, and we have a world line. Now we start adding, so this is the kinetic piece. So now I'm considering the film. not the membrane. I doubt I'll have time to discuss the membrane. And now, in addition, we have stuff that sits on the finite size operators. And we have to put a coefficient here. We'll call this CA and CB. And there are an infinite number of such operators, right? So what are the meanings of these operators? So let's.
Over the circumference.
Right. So depending on what boundary conditions I'll choose, that'll change the values of CA and CB. Okay? As a warm-up exercise, let's take a step back and think about. So actually, in my paper with Walter, we actually discussed the question of electrodynamics. So let's consider first electrodynamics as a warm-up problem, so we can get some physical intuition as to what's going on here. So if we look at the action for a point particle, and that's the point particle action, and we want to include finite size effects, we can start to write down world line terms that look like F squared, or we can look, and that's to leading order in the first derivative corrections. Okay, so we know what the meanings of these coefficients are. We know that, for instance, that CE is related to the electric polarizability of the object. Okay, so this is the Lagrangian for, if I have some sphere and I'm looking at infinity, and I want to ask what are the responses of the sphere to external sources, I can calculate what the response is. I put in an electric field with some background field, right? So this is some E naught. I put it in a background field. And then I can calculate what the response of the system is. So I can calculate delta E will be a convolution of the Green's function with the background electric field. So this is the response, right? And the way I fix the coefficient is I calculate the response, say, of a conductor, which is a simple problem in electrostatics. I calculate the response field, and then I match the two. So in the effective theory, I do the same so this is the calculation I do in the effective theory, and I match this to the full theory solution from chapter 3 of Jackson. And I find exactly that C, so this thing has a C in it, CE. And CE is indeed just equal to the, up to a factor of 4 pi, the polarizability of the sphere. Okay? So the CA and CB are the dipole polarizabilities of the sphere. Now, of course, I haven't told you what the boundary conditions are, but it doesn't matter. Choose any boundary conditions, it'll just change what the dipole polarizability is. So far, I'm assuming spherical symmetry. Otherwise, I'd have to add more operators which break the spherical symmetry. So for instance, in the black hole case, we've heard that we know from Damour and Poisson and Barak and Michaud explain that that is zero for a black hole. That's the analog of the Lub number for the sphere. Okay.
So here.
Yeah, it's the only thing compatible with the symmetry, and that's all you can do, right? So that's the E squared operator in gravity. Okay, so there are some, as a sort of a little side diversion, which is fun. There are some interesting applications to this to chemistry, and quantum chemistry in particular. So so we can use this, say, to calculate forces between molecules. Now this is quantum mechanics. This is just a side diversion. So say I've got two molecules that are neutral, right? So now I'm going to set this charge piece here to zero. I can calculate, for instance, what is the fluctuation-induced force between the two molecules, right? So I have one insertion of F squared here and one insertion of F squared there. And I calculate this Feynman diagram, right? And this gives me a potential that goes like r to the 6 over r to the 7. Now I switched my r's here. This is the radius of this guy. I'm taking it to be the same molecules. And you can actually get that answer without doing any work, because you know that this thing, based on dimensional grounds, goes like r cubed. So I've got two insertions of CE here. So this guy goes like r cubed. And then just on dimensional grounds, I get 1 over r to the 7th. And yes. Yes, would that make you happy, Bar? There you go. Finally.
Is h bar equals 1 unit now?
You can do that.
So, and in fact, you do the calculation. There's a number here. And this just gives you the Casimir Poldar force. That's known as the Casimir Poldar force. You know, this is basic quantum mechanics. You don't need to feel free to do this, but this is a warm-up exercise. OK. So now you could ask the following question, and this will be related to dissipation in a way. So we all know that the van der Waals force goes like 1 over r to the 6. So clearly I'm missing something here. Right? So, what's that? Right. So so you usually think, oh, van der Waals force is a relevant force, but it's not really true. At very long distances, it actually goes like r to the 7th. When it goes r to the 6th, the van der Waals force is more when you have a real system where the typical distance is relevant, is shorter than this. So when you get to shorter distances, it doesn't go like r to the 7th anymore. And the reason is because your effective field theory is breaking down. Okay? So why is that? It's because when you get to distances of order 1 over delta E, where delta E is the energy of the first excitation, it's no longer valid to use this effective field theory, right? So this would be analogous to getting, if you start to get the class black holes close enough together, their horizons will start to overlap. And then you clearly can't just, you have to start including some new physics to account for that, right? So what happens is that as you get closer and closer, you're starting to exchange quanta, which are exciting the atom to the first few excitations, right? And this theory knows nothing about those degrees of freedom. So you have to add degrees of freedom back in to account for those excitations, which is exactly what was discussed by Raphael when he talked about dissipation. So how do we include? We need to include more degrees of freedom that live on the world line, which is exactly what Raphael talked about. Okay? So how do we do that? Well, again, we use symmetry. And we ask ourselves, well, the electric field can couple to degrees of freedom on the world line, right? And they have to couple in a gauge invariant way. And they should couple, we were interested in the lowest dimension operator, the lowest dimension piece, right? Just on dimensional grounds, that, at low energies, that will dominate. But now we can use our intuition, because we know how the electric field couples. So we take our Lagrangian, and we add a piece that goes like P of t times E. Okay? So P of t has the quantum numbers of a dipole moment, a time-dependent dipole moment. So if I start to excite the system, it will start to generate a dipole moment. If I wanted to, calculate higher order corrections, I would couple a quadrupole, an octuple, and so forth. Okay? It's suppressed in powers of V in an unrelativistic case. So now how do I calculate the energy? So the general rule is you calculate all the vacuum graphs. So in this case, it would be something like this. So this looks exactly like what Raphael had on on his transparency.
It's on your paper.
Yeah, that's true too. And now I can calculate this potential. So I calculate this graph, but now I have to take into account. So what's happening here is you have some photon coming in, and it's exciting the modes of the hydrogen atom, whatever it is, right? And it's fairly easy to calculate this, and it gives you V of R is 1 over R to the 6, sum over N M, So all I did is, so this piece here has a expectation value of P of T and T prime. I insert a complete set of states. I do the time integral that gives me the energy denominator, and that's the van der Waals force. Okay? So again, this is standard. You don't need this technology. This is textbook undergraduate or quantum mechanics.
So are you saying to the imaginary part of the propagator?
No. I'm not looking interested in dissipation right now.
You're not
this is not dissipation. No, this is just pure energy.
Yeah, but the question, my question, I guess, is since you have two propagators.
Yes. Right, and that's why
don't you get the product of the real parts plus the product of the imaginary parts?
The product of the real parts plus part. So I take this propagator, I insert a complete set of states, I do the same thing on the bottom, and then I do the time integral, and that's my result.
Yes. I guess maybe I have a little question. So when the intermediate states go on shell, you can have triggered parts.
Yeah, so when you do this sum, remember you don't, there's no degeneracy. So this thing never goes to zero.
Nice.
So I don't need an I epsilon prescription. Otherwise I'd have to do degenerate perturbation. Okay, so the interesting question I have, so notice, so this is just a potential sector, but you can add radiation sector to this. And furthermore, you can do interesting things with nonlinear molecular quantum electrodynamics, because I can start to add F to the fourth operators. Okay, this corresponds to nonlinear responses of molecules. Now I can start to do things like calculate nonlinear energies between molecules. Right? And furthermore, I can insert the radiation photon and start to ask questions about radiation, the effect of radiation molecular effects. So I don't know. I was just out of curiosity, I found this book called Molecular Quantum Electrodynamics. And there's a whole field, and I guess it's related to people who are interested in questions about chemistry. And I would be very interested to see what kind of new results we could come up with using these techniques, but I haven't looked into that. Okay, so let's come back to the problem at hand. So if I start to add more and more terms to the action, those will just be higher and higher order multiple susceptibilities. Okay, so now I want to do the matching. Okay, and what I'll do is I'll show you how to do the matching for the leading order piece, and then hopefully it'll be clear how I can match everything. Okay. So it behooves one to work in two dimensions, to work in, so what we, in using complex coordinates. So I'm gonna write phi as a function of z and z bar. And now we want to map for the z's. So the first step, as you all know, is to put the system in a background field and look for the response of the system to some background. Okay. Now, if I'm interested in matching, we're going to match to the dipole susceptibility. Let me call it C sub D, which in terms of complex coordinates is dz, dz bar up to factors of 2, right? Because the metric in these coordinates is off diagonal. Okay? So so it behooves one to choose the background field to be a dipole field. So this is a dipole of some strength, which I'll just take to be unity. Okay. So now we solve the boundary value problem for the fault theory.
I don't know. Don't you want to divide by R squared? It's the external field, sorry.
Yeah.
It's a 1 over 2 over there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The 2 is irrelevant. So to solve the full theory, so we know that the, so I'm going to choose a boundary condition. Let me choose Neumann. But one could choose Dirichlet if one wished. And so now we write, so phi is equal to our background field, phi background, plus some normalization times 1 over z plus 1 over z bar, which is the response. So why did I choose that as my ansatz for the response? Well, obviously, a dipole will only induce a dipole. This is a cosine theta dependence, which can only induce a cosine theta dependence. So this is a dipole response for a dipole. So this is the standard way you'd, I guess I shouldn't have to do this. This is a solving the trivial problem. OK? So if I saw, I impose the boundary conditions, I find that d phi is r squared over 2 times 1 over z plus 1 over z bar. So then, in other words, that a is r squared over 2. After imposing Neumann on this ansatz, okay? Now, in the effective theory, so on the effective theory side, what we're going to match, right? So we plug in the background field into our action. And then we get that d phi is equal going to be what we call CD, I believe, CD times the convolution of GZ minus Z prime of phi background of Z prime. OK, and then with, I've got the derivatives acting on this as well. OK. So, so now I take the fact that G, the thing that makes two dimensions so simple, those of you who are familiar with 2D systems, is that the Green's function splits up into a holomorphic and anti-holomorphic piece as such. And I plug in this Green's function in here and do the algebra. And we find that C is equal to 2 pi r squared. Okay? Now, okay, so we've solved for the first coefficient, but that's a far cry from solving an infinite number of them. But the beauty of two dimensions is that if I consider an arbitrary number of derivatives, okay, with some coefficient, so I'll call it Cn, so that's the nth tuple susceptibility of the whole, is that this thing reduces down to dz phi to the n, dz bar phi to the n. Okay? Sorry. And the reason is because if, so notice that this is actually, so if I write this, so this is gij di phi dj phi to the n. And so you'd think there'd be terms that go like z. You think there'd be terms that go, well, you know, with dz, dz bar, m, n minus m, right? And that would make things horribly complicated. But those all vanish because they're going to end up operating on this Green's function. So when I do the exact same exercise, right, I'm going to convolve the Green's function with this some number of derivatives corresponding to the nth tuple. And then to do this integral, I do integration by parts. And any number of any time I have a piece which doesn't go, which isn't either pure z or pure z bar, will vanish. Right? And that allows me to do the nth matching. So that. When
you take arbitrary multiple and you solve the problem in sphere. I mean, in three dimensions, if you take a sphere,
yeah,
you take arbitrary multiple,
yeah,
you know how to solve this problem.
Right.
So there is no this nice decomposition, but still it's solvable, you can match anything.
No, you can't, because in three dimensions, what will happen is you'll have, so if I take this sum n, right? Oh, I see, sorry. In three dimensions, no. So what will happen in three dimensions is going to become ridiculously complicated.
No. It's going
yeah.
to be very easy.
No, trust me.
Trust me, I did.
Trust me, you can't solve it in three dimensions.
Well,
okay, I didn't speak for this.
Yeah. Okay. if you could solve it in three dimensions, then you would know the exact Casimir force between two spheres at all distances. And that's not unknown. So
we can discuss it later.
Okay. If you can solve it, that'd be great. You'll be famous.
Yeah, it's one of those Clay prize
problems. Only the prize instead of a million. Only instead of a million dollars.
Okay. So let me tell you the first. So far I haven't said anything about string theory, but now I'm going to, because I'm going to show you that there's an intimate connection between these polarizabilities and string coherence states, which I found surprising, but maybe an expert in the field would not. Okay, so why is that?
Sorry, before you move on.
Yeah.
So before you go to the ZZ bar representation, you can have many, in principle, in equivalent
yeah.
ways of contracting those derivatives.
Yeah,
yes, right.
But now you're saying in compass coordinates, no, in fact,
So notice that I haven't written down anything that goes like this. So anytime you contract the guy with here, that's zero. Because I can use the equation of motion.
Yes. Okay. So it's zero perturbed.
Well, no. So it's, if you can solve the problem, all orders, right? So it's true that if you do a field redefinition in general, you'll generate higher dimension terms. But since I've included all those higher dimension terms, right?
But the equation motion, the nonlinear equation motion are not simply 10 or 0. They are some nonlinear prime.
Oh, but I haven't included anything nonlinear in this theory.
Ah, okay. So you are.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So it's a free theory with.
Free theory. Free theory, yeah. Okay, so what does this have to do? This is just an interesting aside. So what does this have to do with string coherence states? So as I said, in string theory, we're interested in calculating partition functions of surfaces. And in particular, one of the reasons that we're interested in that is to ask questions about, now this is, we're going back to quantum mechanics now. If I have a closed string at time t equals 0, what's the probability of finding it at a later time t prime? So this is some world sheet that looks like that. This is called the closed string propagator. Okay. So, so in our language, you know, so far we're talking just purely classical. There's no time evolution, but this is time evolution of we create a string here and then we annihilate it there. So how do you create a string at time t equals 0? So we impose Neumann boundary conditions on the string. And we want to, so this is, so I'm going to take this to be sigma 1 and this to be sigma 2. And so I'm going to impose, I want this state in the Hilbert space I'm going to call psi. And this state is constrained by this relation. Okay? So this is the string state. And we're trying to solve this constraint to figure out what this string state is here. Okay, so this is a zero-dimensional string theory because I have a scalar field, right? So this is zero-dimensional gravity. So I promised you I'd talk at least gravity at some point during my talk. So we want to solve this constraint, and the solution to this constraint you can look up in Polchinski's book. No, the, well, yeah, 0 plus 1. The target space is zero, is no indices. One index, yeah. Sorry. So the solution to this constraint is, so in terms of oscillator modes on the string, the left movers and right movers, that's that constraint. These are creation and annihilation operators on the string, for those of you who are not familiar with this. So the solution to this is a string coherence state. Where this is the closed string vacuum. So in terms of fields, though, this is where things start to look familiar. If I rewrite this in terms of the fields, this is equal to alpha prime is a string coupling. Okay? So that's interesting, because what is that? That's nothing but an insertion of our world line action. This is exactly our world line action, right? This is an infinite sum. And the coefficient is exactly the same. Okay? Which is to say that, so this, what is this? So this sum is creating, if I expand its exponential, that's creating string excitations. So this coherence state, which obeys Neumann boundary conditions, is an infinite tower of string excitations, right? And the weight of each one of those excitations corresponds to the susceptibility in our statistical system.
What happened to R?
Yeah, so I have to, R is an overall scale factor I would have to include. So if I said, and I don't think I have the pi's in there either, or the, but I didn't put all the factors in, but it's interesting. So for instance, if you look at the dipole susceptibility, that is the tachyon excitation of the string. So the lowest excitation of the string is a tachyon in the closed string. And the state that you're creating here is a state with some weight of the tachyon in it and some string excitations. Those weights are exactly the Wilson coefficients which match the polarizabilities. Okay? And from an operator point of view, you could think of this as an operator insertion in the path integral, which is exactly our Hamiltonian, which I wrote down up there, which is an insertion of that. Well, that's exactly what we've done. We've inserted those finite size operators into the path integral, right? So it's interesting that you could get this exact result by looking at the closed string and pull off all the Wilson coefficients without doing any matching or anything like that. OK, this was just a sort of interesting side note. So now let's get back to solving the problem. But notice that this was, I mean, I didn't look at the string propagator. I just asked the question, what does it take to create the proper state, right? And we figured out what the Hamiltonian is just by imposing Neumann boundary conditions. OK, so now how do we, so I've got, I know I've got the exact action. So the S finite size effects, or the H of the finite size, we know is the sum over n, 2 to the n, dz to the n phi, dz bar to the n phi. And I know the cn's. So I can actually write this down. I can do this sum in closed form. And this thing is equal to, so H exact is D2Z times a sum of RA Bessel function over A. OK? So this sum you could do in closed form, and it looks exactly like this. It sums into a Bessel function operating on these fields and summed over all positions of the particles, and RAs are the radiuses of the particles, right? So this is the exact action, including all finite size effects, for a point particle to reproduce the statistical mechanics of an arbitrary number of holes on the Euclidean plane. Okay, this is the arbitrary number of holes. Now I haven't calculated, now I need to use it to calculate the free energy, but that's a relatively simple thing to do, and this is the result. Okay? So how do I calculate the free energy? Well, this theory is now is completely Gaussian, and all I have to do is calculate all the bubble diagrams. So this is exactly like what we do in NRGR with insertions of this operator. And that's what that infinite sum is. Now, you have to insert, you insert an operator at A here, an operator at B here, an operator at A, and so forth all the way around. And when you do that, that leads to that expression, which is pretty ugly. Okay? But nonetheless, that expression, so if you expand that expression, you reproduce all the results in the known literature plus an infinite number of new results. OK. OK, and I'm not gonna expand it for you. But what I would like to do for you before, I don't know how I'm doing on time. Walter, what do I got?
You got about 10 minutes.
OK, all right.
Calculations.
It looks like there's still interest, so I'll continue. Of course, I could just be deluding myself.
can you say something about the experimental relevance of the higher order terms there?
Yeah, so let me come back though, because I want to make sure I get through. So the interesting thing is you can also solve this using conformal field theory. And I'm not going to go through the solution. Actually, let me leave it here. But let me tell you how it's done. So you notice that the plane with two holes, right, can be mapped to an annulus by an inversion, right? And the annulus can be mapped to a cylinder, okay? So you would say, oh, okay, well, this should be totally trivial because it's conformally invariant. I do a conformal transformation, which takes me, I couldn't just go through all the way to the end. And the calculation on the cylinder, of course, is a textbook exercise. And you say, well, that's the answer. And the answer is not true because the free energy is not conformally invariant. Right? The stress energy tensor in a conformal field theory is not really a tensor, right? Or it's sometimes called it's a quasi-primary operator. And it doesn't transform like it should. It has this extra piece known as the Schwarzian. But in addition, when you have boundaries, the boundaries also break conformal invariance. Okay? So if you wanted to do this, so there's some mapping between here and here, which you can get by a Weyl rescaling. Okay? And there's an anomaly which tells you how to calculate the free energy in going from this step to that step. Okay? So in particular, it was shown a long time ago by Alvarez that there is an invariant conformal transformation. So this is what we're interested in, because remember the determinant is the partition function, right? So L here, let me tell you what this is. So this is the Gaussian, the geodesic curvature of the boundary of the surface you're mapping to. This is the boundary. And L is given as an integral over the Gaussian curvature. So it's M. Phi is the scaling factor. Okay. So that's an invariant, and these extra pieces that you pick up are due to the anomaly. Okay. So I'm not going to go through the calculation. It's relatively straightforward. Takes a little bit of work because you have to figure out what the mappings are. So the mappings are a little bit non-trivial, which I will skip. And I will just write down what the answer is. Let me write it down over here. So, as I said, when I first started thinking about this problem, I did a literature check to see if anyone has actually calculated this. And I think the answer is no, that I know of. And I have asked as many experts as I can, and no one seems to know that this calculation has been done, which I found a little bit strange. But the answer is minus beta f is equal to log of f of r squared. Now I've taken the two spheres to have the same, and f have the same radius. F of x is related to the Dedekind function that one finds in conformal field theories. So there is a beautiful closed form solution. And if you compare this solution to that solution, I would clearly take the conformal field theory solution any day of the week, right? And if you expand out this result, then you find that these two, as a series expansion in R, you find that these two results give you the same thing. Okay, so this, sorry, this should be little r, and I've scaled r to 1. Okay, so you can as I said, these two solutions upon expansion give you the same result. Now, of course, the conformal field theory result has multiple advantages over this result, most notably that the Dedekind function has many representations. So you can plug it into Mathematica and evaluate it rather quickly. Whereas evaluating the series becomes difficult as you go to higher number of terms. Okay. Now, however,
how do you know that they're the same?
Pardon me?
How do you know that they're the same?
Well, I think a graduate student at CMU expanded them both out to 75th order.
Wow.
So I figured they needed to check 76, but I don't know.
Is that grad student called Mathematica?
What's that? No, I was too lazy to do it. Grad student has a different name.
Okay, but then there should be a simple proof.
There could be, I don't know. I didn't spend too much time thinking about it.
Sorry, little r is the distance? Or
little r is the distance. Yes. If I wrote my notes down right, then the radius has been scaled to 1 at this point.
So r is bigger than 1. Little r is bigger than 1.
Little r is bigger than 1. Correct. Okay, so. Now let me tell you why I like the, in some case I think the effective field theory can solve things that the conformal field theory can't. So there are three cases I can think of. So for instance, so let me tell you the three cases. There's one nice case which I really like, which shows the power of the matching. So in particular, I've been doing spheres. Okay, but suppose I wanted to do, I don't know, ellipses or rods with arbitrary orientations like that. If I wanted to use the conformal field theory result, I'd have to figure out how to map that to the cylinder. Okay, and that starts to get, it's very simple to map an ellipse, of course, to a circle, but it's very hard to map two ellipses to a cylinder, especially when ellipses have arbitrary semi-major and semi-minor axes, okay? But the nice thing about the effective field theory result is it doesn't care, because when you do the matching, you still have conformal symmetry at your disposal, okay? So what I do is I match to a circle, right? This is a standard trick that you learn in undergraduate complex analysis. If you solve a system in two dimensions, right, which is with a harmonic kernel, right, then you can map it, and it's conformally invariant. I perform a conformal map, and I find a new solution. So I can find an infinite number of solutions, right? So I can find anything which is deformable, right, from the circle, which is everything, but anything with a nice transformation, like an ellipse, you can solve all the matching coefficients exactly. Yeah?
Can I now use the result from the EFD to inform how the transformation would be? You probably mapping would be in the CFD side to the cylinder.
In principle, it's hidden in there, but I haven't. Seems like it would be a hard problem. So yeah. So what you do is you map you match to the circle, right? So now in this case, of course, I've got more operators because now I have tensor polarizabilities. And so it gets more complicated. But a graduate student at CMU, Robert Hausman, has actually done this matching calculation and calculated all the infinite number of matching coefficients with an arbitrary number of n's here. Okay, so there are an infinite number of tensor polarizabilities, and you calculate all of them by taking into by using the fact that you have conformal symmetry.
For an ellipse, you mean?
Pardon me?
For an ellipse, you mean?
For an ellipse and any, so an arc, anything that's any shaped ellipse, so you can make it a rod, and also with arbitrary orientations, obviously. Yeah.
And you don't have any linear in phi because you don't have permanent multiples.
Yeah, there's only induced multiples.
Meaning phi goes zero is always a solution.
Yeah, if the circle's sitting there, it doesn't do anything. Doesn't induce a field or an excitation. There are interesting questions. So what happens, for instance, if you do? So in fact, so I sort of decoupled from those guys, but now they're starting to look at things like, what if I put something in that deforms it like this and has permanent moments?
Or like, I don't know, on trivial boundary conditions on the circle, but trivial infinity, so that inevitably you need something.
No, but I think any boundary condition will be at least quadratic if it feels. No?
Why? I mean, if I say phi equal 1 on the circle, but phi equal 0 at infinity.
Yeah, that's like taking the membrane and pushing it down, right? And then that induces that a field. That's like having a monopole moment.
Yes.
But yeah, and I think that now that those guys are going to start to look at these things. So anyway, I you can write down the values for all those infinite number coefficients for ellipses. So that's one, I think, nice benefit of doing things in this way. The other thing is, one sec, Jeff. So imagine you wanted to calculate three holes, okay? In the CFT, or in the string theory case, you would have to map it to the pants diagram, right? Something like that. And you'd have to figure out this conformal mapping. And as far as I know, that's not known either. Okay. So in my paper, I wrote down an exact expression for the three-hole case using the effective field theory result, but it's ugly, unfortunately. But you might be able to massage the sum. So for instance, Jim has shown that some of these sums, you can actually do some of the sums. When you have multiple sums, turn them into hypergeometrics. But there's always one infinite sum left over at this point. Okay.
Iron?
Yeah.
Is there still a relation to the coherence of the string property or the string study? For these.
You mean if you deform it?
Yeah.
So I would imagine so, that this just relates. Well, no. No, it's more complicated than that. I take it back. No, I don't know. Because now they're just not numbers. You can't just weight the string excitations because they're tensors. Oh. So there might be some relation between those tensors. I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
But the infinite sum you were just mentioning right now, it's always a sum over, it's an hierarchical sum over multiples. No? Meaning if the holes are very far away from each other, you can be okay.
Oh, yeah. But so the thing is, in conformal field theory methods, you get the exact answer. So it depends. If you're interested in experiment, then yes. Who cares about getting the exact solution? Although sometimes they are interested in when they're very close to each other. So there's something called the Darjagian or near proximity approximation, which is the inverse of this approximation. So the nice thing about the closed form result that I wrote down in terms of the Bessel function, at least, is that's valid to arbitrary, not Bessel function, the Dedekind is valid to arbitrary distances. So one of the things you could check are these near proximity approximations. But in general, you'd like to have as accurate as possible because when they can do these experiments in the laboratory. So coming back to Andy's question, so there, I believe what I've been told is that these are very difficult experiments to do. Because, for reasons which I'm ignorant, but I could guess, which would be a waste of your time. So anyway, they're hard. So
so why did the condensed matter crowd prefer to go to third order or second order?
Why do they?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think they're trying to get as accurate as possible. So one of the things that Marcus and I are interested in is to understand how big the nonlinear corrections are, right? you want to know how good this expansion in 1 over R is behaving because you want to have it right. There are also people, you can compare it to Monte Carlos because there are people that run computer simulations of these things. In fact, so if you compare our result to the computer simulation, it matches really well. And then when you get close, their errors get big and you can't. They get big errors also when they get closer to each other. So anyway, I think there's lots of interesting calculations that are yet to be done using this method as applied to these systems, but there's no reason why it has to be just this, right? I mean, you can apply it to anything. You could apply it to electrodynamics to try to understand oddly shaped objects and how they interact through vacuum fluctuations as well. You wouldn't be able to solve it exactly in 3 dimensions. But you could, in the 1 over R approximation, you know, which is usually what people do when they're interested in Casimir forces. So the reason this seems to be of interest these days is because of nanotechnology, right? So there's a problem with Casimir effects. When you start putting gears together very closely, they start to repel, right? And so the question is, if you really want to build something at nanoscales and take into account you need to account for this Casimir friction, then you need to be able to know how to handle it and design devices which you know, are maximally efficient taking that into account. So that, I think, is also a really interesting question. Because you can start to ask questions like, if I'm looking at the interaction between gears and they have protuberances on them, right? They have cogs, right? I can treat those cogs as insertions of operators and start to ask questions, what is the torque between the two cogs? And in principle, what's that? So then you can start to ask, you can start to, you know, to do those calculations in a systematic way. Okay, thank you for listening.